Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.
see family. I'm Brother Yusuf, and I'm one of the producers on the Ringing Soul Network. So I'd like to welcome you to our second seminar. So we're trying to implement some cultural pride, as opposed to that you can sit down with your family, grandchildren, and listen to the storyteller, the Griot, Professor Griot of story. Well, we're trying to bring back some arts on Friday out the month. Where you don't do franchising, just stay at home and just build. Let them be dark for professional Griot. I'm not the original producer of this. This show is produced by the Magnolia Tree Institute that's coming off Washington Crossing. Dr. Wanda Alahart. She is the executive producer of this show. And Dr. Wanda, will you press one, please, so I can record? Press one, then I open the line and he can take over the narration. But keep in mind, we do on Sunday, we do remnant work. So this network is about helping, and it's about self. On Sunday, it's about going to court, foreclosure, what have you. And on Thursday, that's a stand. We have a brother, Robert, he goes into how you can find the store, so he gives you information. That day to implement your plans. We also added Brother Ray and equity on the court. So trying to do things in terms of what's going on. Let me see if I can find Mr. Wanda. Are you there?
Shalom, shalom.
Shalom. Hold on. I'm trying to find
Brother, you see too. Maybe check that it is breaking up a little bit.
Okay, but will you press one? Press one so that I have your number at the top of the queue, please.
All
just
right.
Press one. Okay.
That's better.
All right. Well, family, that's participating in our family night. Thanks for coming. Right now, I want to give you Dr. Wanda Alahart, which is the executive producer of our family night. Welcome, Dr. Alahart. Thank you. For helping create one of my dreams is to become a family on Blog Talk. Peace and love.
Peace and blessings. Peace and blessings, family. Thank you for joining us again tonight with the Magnolia Tree Institute of Ancient Wisdom here in Monroe, Louisiana. I'm Queen Mother Alahart, mystical storyteller. I am delighted to be able to bring you some dynamic griots this evening. We're going to start out with a call from 612. And that is 222-8161. You'll be our first griot. Would you please welcome her? Give her your undivided attention. Sit down with your gumbo. Sit down with your cup of tea and get ready to be taken to elevated heights with the ancient tales that we have planned for you tonight. 612, you're on.
Yeah, this is Brenda Bell Brown. I'm calling you from Memphis, Tennessee. This is by spirit only. Actually, that 612 number is Minneapolis, Minnesota. But my story is based in my home of the South, Memphis, Tennessee. Again, my name is Brenda Bell Brown, and I send you greetings. Thank you so very much for having me on your roster tonight. I will try to do my best to appease the spirit, appease your ears, and to definitely get my soul blessed. Ready for it?
Yes.
Here it go. The story is called Memphis Suki's Anthem. And speaking in terms of ancient wisdom, it's all about answering the question of what lies on top of the pyramid. Memphis Suki's Anthem. Who would have thought that a little old country baseball game would warrant all this? I was already nervous. This is the first time that my sister, my big sister, had asked me to do anything for any of her singing engagements. Her singing engagements were a big to-do. They were the butterflies that had to be held at bay with plenty of honey and lemon and sweet water gargles and trills without end, and piano accompaniment morning, noon, and night. Mama's fingers got tired doing the scales over and over again. Mama was the perfectionist, you know. Daddy tried to mess with perfection a lot. He stepped in with his two cents on the standards that Mama insisted on for her songbird, my sister, Spooky. Me, I would always laugh at Daddy's attempts to jazz up even the most dull music piece. A Duke Ellington lift to Ave Maria, or an Ella Fitzgerald doo-wop to Handel. He, even at this moment, was trying to throw in a Rosetta, Sister Rosetta Tharpe throatiness to the Star-Spangled Banner. I listened to Suki trying to satisfy Mama's sweethearted attempts to follow Daddy's directions on the piano while staying true to what the poet, the music, and more to the point, the occasion that the song was called for this time. As I lie on my bed, I practice how high and steady I would hold my confetti bomb blast, popping them at just the right moment, on the breath before Suki sang, "Brave." Lying on my back with my arms stretched out at a 45-degree angle from my body, I noticed how strong I was getting after weeks of practice. No shaking, no pain, or anything. I only had one breath to pull the tiny strings and let the confetti fly upward, aiming for the palms of Suki's outstretched hands, taking care not to hit her in the head, and most definitely not aiming down to the dirt below and behind the pitcher's mound, the area between her and me. I was aiming for perfection. It is imperative that my job be performed as a quick maneuver, one that I deftly practiced with Daddy's coaching. His approach required the use of book matches to simulate the maneuver proper. This was the first and only time that I had been allowed to play with matches. The poppers were expensive to practice with, you see. So Daddy brought a dime store box of book matches, and we stood on the gravel side of the garden, just a striking and holding on to books of matches until the air surrounding us was streaked with wafts of sulfur and smoke. A pail of water was set close by so that we could douse the fire-darkened spent books. Oh, it was a messy affair. Once I got a good at the trick of striking a bent match in a closed cover with my right hand, I got ambidextrous with it. The thumb on my left hand got so tired in the beginning, but I was soon able to strike two matches simultaneously in can. My daddy hit my back so hard when I did it three times in a row that he almost knocked me into Mama's flower garden. Ashen thumbs aside, I felt great. He quickly pulled out the practice lot of poppers, and I blast them on cue like I was a fireworks lighter on the 4th of July. I am good. The big day was only a night away. On the night before the big game, the last thing to prepare was the redo of a velvet and satin dress that used to be one of Mama's holiday out-on-the-town evening gowns. Coach asked that Suki be as elegantly dressed as the team during the season opener. At this game, the team was going to be showing off their brand new uniforms, not the ones that were still wearing from the time they played for high school or the Army or the Marines or whatever. Truth be told, that hodgepodge of colors and styles made our team stand out whenever they played a better uniformed white team from across the tracks, which they usually did by the end of the season because they were that good. Talent was talent, no matter what uniform you wore. This season, however, with the installation of the sewing room in the new Votech wing at the local high school and the timely appearance of both heavyweight material and a boat of red satin, things had changed. The ladies' auxiliary, along with a host of female students, eager to please fathers, brothers, uncles, cousins, and boyfriends. Did I miss titles of acquaintance to be had by any of our baseball players? Yes. They were led by Miss Brevan, the home ec / sewing teacher. They got to sewing on that material, and voila, brand new uniforms, fitted and new. Coach, who is our favorite Uncle Benny, wanted Suki to look just as good. His niece was going to shine just like his players on this game night, the night when they start their season out playing the team from across the tracks. Like I said, they had proven it. They were that good. Uncle Benny kept saying, I don't care if she hits a sour note and the boys play like all their limbs are sprained or broken. I just want them to shine. Actually, he did care. He just didn't want anybody to get nervous about a little old game. So on this night before the big game, I held my arms high over my head as I lie in bed listening to Suki to sing my cue. Brave, come on now. Breath. Brave, Suki, brave. My arms were still in that position as I drifted off to sleep. Mama and Daddy were trying to work out every little last detail of the song before Suki's 9 o'clock bedtime. As far as I know, with all their soft, strong arguing, Suki never made it to the end of the song. One thing for sure, Suki's rest must have been more important than perfection, because when I got up around midnight to go pee, I heard the piano downstairs pounding out some unrecognizable tune that sure didn't sound like the Star Spangled Banner. The dress, it turned out beautiful. Suki stood on the mound, dressed in a green velvet and red satin remake of Mama's Christmas evening gown. It was made into a two-piece that fitted my sister like a dream. The velvet green top had an empire cut bodice and a ducktail back with a full red satin skirt that flowed to the ground in soft gathers around her tiny waist. The gathers primarily came from the elastic in the skirt waist. Mama didn't have time to put a zipper in. Elastic had to do. I was dressed to compliment her in a light gray cotton dress with pink satin bows in my hair and a matching pink sash around my waist. I fussed about the pink lace yoke collar around my neck, but Mama made me see how pretty it would look with my pink organza petticoat and pink stockings and white patent leather shoes. She was right. She always is, Mama is, when it comes to outfits. Game time, and we were ready and set to go. I wanted my hair to flow like Suki's, but as the breeze picked up on the playing field, I was kind of glad that my two braids were plaited tight down my neck. I would have hated to have to use my hands to brush away hair from my face. That move would surely have made me drop the confetti poppers, and that would not do. The announcer loudly called, accompanied by her baby sister, Roberta, Memphis's very own songbird, Suki Roberts, will now sing the Star-Spangled Banner. All right. I hoped that the standing crowd would not be confused when I did not open my mouth and start singing with my sister. Even if they were, I did not care. I just hailed for my cue as my sister, the greatest singer alive, Suki Roberts, took a deep breath and sang, oh, say can you see? Suki's voice rang out clear and sweet. The microphone helped, but God's wind was what truly carried her voice around the field and out into the world. She opened her mouth, and the words came out clear and strong. She took in breaths at the right moments and pushed out the song a cappella. No instrument was needed to support this natural. She was a slight thing who knew how to belt, belt, belt. Oh, my word. Suki was belting hard, trying to satisfy the throatiness that Daddy asked her to try, a la Rosetta Nubian style. Oh, my word. Suki was hitting note after note, stretching her slight frame to lift each note high to the sky. Oh, my word. Suki's skirt was sliding down. My eyes scanned the crowd, their eyes opened wide, and watched Suki's skirt slowly slip over her hips, down her legs, towards the pitcher's mound. It was all I could do to hold firm and not drop the confetti blast, to keep from running, to keep my Suki from exposing her lower half to the crowd, the world, and God. I saw folks' hands go from covering their hearts to covering their mouths, their eyes widening at the inevitable slide of satin from hips to ground. Suki. That Suki kept on smiling and singing, and with one deft move, she lifted her arms and sidestepped into a long, black, slip-covered gap leg stance to ring out, "And the home of the brave." Oh, my smile matched hers as I popped the confetti corks on cue. Brilliant yellow, blue, red, and green streamers shot up into the air. I imagined the scene as if I were looking from the grandstand out to Suki. At the moment of the song's climax, effective as effective can be, Suki's black hair was blowing in the wind. Her red satin skirt was flowing and blowing from around her ankles. Her legs were the armature for a black slip-covered triangle that held a live green velvet-clad bust of Memphis's singing angel atop its pinnacle. Streams of confetti shot into the air as if coming from the open hands of her outstretched arms. The flashes of brilliant yellow were especially nice as they flew up against the black drop backdrop. Crowd cheered. The announcer cried out, "Play ball!" Moving as if released, Suki lifted me with one hand, stepped out of and scooped up her skirt with the other. As we ran towards home plate, we were both laughing as hard as the players who ran to take their positions on the field, tipping their caps to us as they went. We won! We won! We won! And that was Memphis Suki's anthem. And I hope it answered the question of what sits on top of the pyramid.
Yes. Thank you. That's lovely. That speaks to the genius of the woman. Thank you so much for that story.
You're so very welcome, sister. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuhu. And moving on, I'd like to give a little something before we bring on our next griot. This is just a little transformation poem from an author that I enjoy reading by the name of Jalaluddin Rumi. And these are called transformation mantras. Gold becomes constantly more and more beautiful from the blows the jeweler inflicts on it. Realize that what you have found difficult is bringing you closer to your goal. Before death takes what has been given to you, you must give away everything you can give. Generosity is the key to everything you really want. Act now. How can victory be won without spiritual war and patience? Give proof of patience. Faith is the key to joy. Trust that a happy outcome is bound to come in time. Say with each breath, "Make me humbler, make me humbler." When you are small as an atom, you will know his glory. The potential of the situation will be revealed only to humble minds and hearts. If you know how to be patient, He'll offer you the seat of honor. He'll show you a hidden way that no one will know. Things seem impossible. Wait and trust, and you will be shown the solution. How many years you need for the ruby? Do the sun's work to obtain its rich color and its dazzle. Great projects and achievement require time and patience. Success will take time, but will come. Put your trust in Him who gives life and ecstasy. Don't mourn what doesn't exist. Cling to what does. Don't look back at the past. Turn your head to wisdom and truth. Anyone who asks to be illuminated now will be made a torch to light up the world. This is a time radiant with blessings. Realize your deepest dreams. Through love, disaster becomes good fortune. Through love, a prison becomes a garden. The way from defeat to victory runs through love. Things are never as bad as you imagine them to be. And with that, I would like to welcome our next griot, area code 318. If you would push 1 on your phone to come in.
Shalom, shalom, Shabbat shalom.
Shalom, Shabbat, and thank you for joining us tonight.
More than welcome, you're more than welcome. You ready for me now?
Yes, I'm ready for you now. You will introduce yourself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, first and foremost, I give all honor and glory to the Creator of the heavens and earth. Yahweh Israel, and to all divine brothers and sisters who have come out, my divine pleasure. I'm Ore Elidode, and my participation for this evening is centered around the Israelites, the House of Israel platform. We, the descendants of the captives, brought to the New World during the transatlantic Holocaust, have risen to re-embrace our Hebrew heritage, customs, and way of life. We, the House of Israel in exile, have chosen the Torah, teachings of Moses, as our spiritual, judicial, and social foundation to rebuild our civilization. Number 3, we choose self-reliance and self-empowerment as our course of action. Although we do participate in the U.S. economic and political process, we are fully aware that the Gentile system is not built in the interest of our people. Number 4, we maintain the right to repatriate to the African country of our choice. This includes the land of Israel and Northeast Africa. 5, we request U.S., European, and foreign assistance for our reparation from the land of captivity. We individually and collectively pledge to work to establish a Yah-focused, moral, Torah-based civilization in our new homeland that will serve as a light to all nations. What was the ethnic origin and the physical appearance of the ancient Israelites? According to ancient history and the Holy Scriptures, Babylonia's capital was Ur. This city was the birthplace of the great Hebrew patriarch Abraham, who was the son of Terah. Genesis 11 and 1. I just want to point out about Ur, Babylonian provenance. And you might ask yourself, what did these people look like? Who were they? Well, according to our historians, this was all a part of Nimrod's buildings. Nimrod was an Ethiopian. He was a Cushite. So we find that the people who lived in Ur, the birthplace of the patriarch Abraham, were Cushites. Chronology of Israelite civilization. Moses leads Israel out of Egypt. Joshua leads Israel into Canaan. The period of Judges. Joshua, Othniel, Ehud, Deborah, Gideon, Abimelech, Yaphtah, Isban, Elon, Abdan, Shimshon, Micha, the Danites, the Levite, Israelite Confederation against Benjamin, Boaz, Elah, Samuel. The period of united monarchy, Saul, Hebrew, Shaul, David, David, Solomon, Shlomo, Israel, Yehuda. Division, 19 kings of Judah. One queen of Judah. 20 kings of Israel. Destruction of Israel, 721 BCE. Destruction of Judah, 586 BCE. Captivity among nations, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, East-West Roman Empire, Europe, Africa, the USA, EU, UN, China, Japan, Arab Emirates. Abraham, the first Hebrew, Genesis 14 and 3, was born of Terah, who, according to Hebrew and Islamic tradition, was the chief minister of King Nimrod, the Cushite, ruler of ancient Babylon, now Iran. Abram, a Shemite, was physically a black man born of a black father, living in a land ruled by a black king. Abram, or Avram, migrated to Canaan, a country inhabited by the Canaanites, sons of Kim, a black people. Afterwards, Abram of Egypt, Africa, and lived among them as one of their own until it was discovered that Sarai was his wife instead of his sister. His wife, who was, in fact, also his half-sister, was also back of the same ethnic background. Abram, or Avram, begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob. All of these patriarchs were Shemitic and black in appearance. In fact, they could not be distinguished from any ancient, from ancient Egyptians. When Jacob sent his sons to Egypt to buy grain because of the famine, they brought their brother Joseph. They thought their brother Joseph was an Egyptian, yet he was Hebrew. Genesis 42, chapter 43rd chapter and 45th chapter. Moses, a Hebrew, was mistaken as an Egyptian. See Exodus 2, 16 through 19. Jacob and his family, 70 souls, went into Egypt, Africa. The scripture says, and after 430 years, they grew to a multitude of 600,000 Hebrew men, not including women and children. In order for this large number of Hebrews to exist, there had to be a large number of Hebrew intermingling with Egyptians, Africans. See Leviticus 24, 10, and 11. 1 Chronicles 2, 34 and 35. Numbers 11 and 2. And Numbers 12 and 1. Remember, this was the origin of the Hebrew people. And as you will discover, its foundation was certainly black or of color. You can also read Zephaniah 3 and 10, Daniel 7, chapter 9, verse, Psalms 80 and 8 for additional references. Whatever happened to the ancient Israelites after their exodus from Egypt, Africa? After wandering in the wilderness for 40 years and the death of Moses, the children of Israel entered into the land of Canaan, another part of Northeast Africa. Initially, a system of judges was established, which continued until the anointing of King Saul. After the death of King Saul, David became king of Judah, then Israel. His son, King Solomon, reigned in his father's stead and built a temple unto the name of Yahweh, the Almighty God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. After the 40-year rulership of Solomon, King Solomon, the United Kingdom of Israel divided into two parts, Israel and Judah. Both the kingdoms of Israel and Judah fell before great powers such as Assyria, Babylonia, Persia, Greece, Rome, and eventually the Western Europe, including America. See 2 Kings 17, chapter 1 with the 41st verse. Why did the ancient Israelite kingdom fall? The kingdom of Israel would not keep the laws given to them by Moses, who had received them from Yah at Mount Sinai. Instead, they refused his laws and commandments and statutes and worshiped false gods, religions, as they continued to do until this very day. Because of this, the Creator rejected his people and removed them into all kingdoms of the earth as slaves until they would repent and turn back to him and only him. See Psalms 106, 26, and 27. Leviticus 26, 32 through 34. And Jeremiah 21 and 7. According to Bible prophecies, after the Creator had dispersed the sons and daughters of Israel, he also revealed that if they would return back to his laws, statutes, and judgments, that he would be their God and they would be his people. And he would bring them back to the land of their ancestors. I would like to say further that if you thoroughly examine the biblical history of the children of Israel, and compare it with the history of Black America, you will find that there is a very distinct parallel. We are a distinct people. And the history of our people in the diaspora shows how important it is to understand that no other people on this earth could have experienced what our people experienced, except they were the biblical, historical children of the Most High. No one could withstand the punishment that they withstood. And all through the Holy Scriptures, it is written that our people would suffer. And when you read Deuteronomy, the 28th chapter, we find another parallel, strong parallel, between our ancestors and what happened here in North America. Genesis the 12th chapter, I believe it's Deuteronomy, 28th chapter and the 12th verse, says, and when the sun was going down, Avram, whose name later was changed to Ephraim,
yes, I'm still here. It seemed like we had a little drop.
Yeah, I heard a beep, and then a blank.
I
just got a few more
lines
to read, and then I'm going to move on. There is a strong parallel, biblically and prophetically, between the prophecies as it relates to children of Abraham, so-called African American, strong resemblance. The Creator told Abraham, know of a surety that thy seed would be strangers in the land, not theirs, and they would serve and be afflicted 400 years. And we're looking at 1419 as the beginning of that 400 years. And that nation whom they shall serve, the Creator said, will I judge. And therefore we see hello.
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay.
If you would just pause for one, I just want to check with the technician. Are we having technical difficulties, Brother Yusiku? All right, continue, please. He didn't respond.
Okay. So we see the Bible prophecies as a blueprint foreshadowing our experiences as a people here in North America as the identical parallel to what happened to our ancestors in ancient Egypt. And talks much about deliverance. So I'm going to hold it right there and call close out my portion with a brief chant of the 133rd Psalms, which reads, "Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren and sisters to dwell together in unity. It is like the precious ointment upon the head that ran down upon the beard, even Aaron's beard that ran down to the skirts of his garments, as the dew of Hermon that descended upon the mountains of Zion. For there the Lord commanded the blessing, even life forevermore. Ine mato manaim shevetachim gam yachan. Ine mato manaim shevetachim gam yachan. Ine mato shevetachim gam yachan. Thank you. Tula Rabba. Shalom.
Tula Rabba. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you so much for that ancient wisdom that is truly oil for my soul. And if you can stay with us, we will have a question and answer at the end of the program. And those who would like to ask a question or offer a comment at the end, you'll be offered the opportunity to do so by pushing one on your phone. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. I am so touched at this moment. Again, appreciate your wisdom and exaltation to you. And before we get on to our next story, I'd like to share more words of wisdom. Love has come to rule and transform. Stay awake, my heart, stay awake. Be acutely aware of the hidden teachings and blessings you are about to receive. The fragrance, my friend, that floats to you this moment streams from the tent of the secrets of God. Your life has reached a decisive and very positive turning point. The world grows green again and turns with gardens. Hues from the mines glitter in each tree. Souls open like suns and link with one another. Harmony and prosperity join hands. In your life, be grateful. Happiness is more precious than wealth. May millions of mercies rain on your dancing. You have chosen inner joy and not power in the world. This is why God is blessing you. They offered many reasons why the rose is laughing. None of them knew the truth. Its prayer has been granted by spring. The true reason for the joy you feel is that it comes from divine grace. Look for the soul, you become soul. Hunt for the bread, you become bread. Whatever you look for, you are. Be careful, what you choose could determine what you become. Your soul was a snake, but it is now a fish. It leaps in the spring of immortal life. Love and hard work changed you from someone who was struggling into someone who lives in joy. You touched the egg of my heart. It broke apart. The bird of heaven is opening its wings. Inspiration of all kinds flood your mind. Seize the time. Open your eyes and you will see the last. He is walking in your garden like the breeze of dawn. Have the courage to count your blessings, and you will find hidden resources. And I'd also like to offer a mystical story here called The Story of Death. There is not enough room, the people were crying. There's not enough room. It was true. Plants were so thick on the forest floors that the strongest knives could not cut past through them. Corn and rice grew so high in the fields that they towered like trees over the people. People had not enough to eat in those times because no one died. Babies came and grew bigger and bigger, but people did not get old, and they never left the earth. That was when the goddess Kali turned over in her sleep. The people's cry, "There's not enough room," became part of her dream. But she must have been ready to awake, because the next cry, "There's not enough room," woke her, and she sat up. "You disturbed my sleep," she bellowed, rubbing her eyes with her fists. "There's not enough room," the people cried. Kali drew on her robes. She walked to her window and threw it open to look out on the world. She put her dark hands on the sill and leaned out, her black hair ruffled in the wind. What she saw made her draw back into her room. She saw crowds of people piled on each other, none of them old, all of them elbowing each other to get at vats for food, and the buildings crammed together so tightly it was hard to see the sky. Animals swarmed through the throngs. The air was hot with sweat and perfume and soil. Kali inside licked her lips. Her hands went to her hips. "Time!" she yelled. Her servant Time came running. "Bring me my red sari," she ordered. Time brought the garment, dark as the color of blood. Kali threw off the gray robes of sleep and fastened the red about her. "Clothe yourself," she said to her servant. "We are going out, and bring me my jewels." Time did as bidden. She took up her gray robes for herself and put on shoes the shape of fish. Then he brought Kali her necklace, glinting with skulls. "Take these," Kali said, and she thrust gifts wrapped in golden paper into Time's hands. "Now call my chariot." The chariot came, pulled by 8 white stallions and 8 black mares. Fire leapt from its wheels when Kali and Time climbed to its platform. With a loud cry, Kali raised her hand and let loose the rein. The horses smoked across the distance to earth. Before each village, Kali drew in the rein. Her servant Time stepped from the chariot and handed the gold-wrapped gifts to people who crowded at each stop. In each package, the people found Kali's gifts: spider webs, dust, decay, mold, worms, rust, mushrooms, crumbling rot, mildew, the smell of rich earth aging. It was on that day the crops knew more than just blooming and growing. They knew also the withering that returned them to the soil. It was on that day that the plants of the forest floor began to add to the blackness of the soil so the trees could grow. Animals had babies, but now the babies grew old. Humans too began to age. They also began to die, so there would be room for their children. Kali and her servant Time returned to her palace. Exhausted, she fell, still crimson clothes across her bed. Time undressed her gently and tucked her under the covers. Kali is a goddess who dances at funerals and sometimes stops babies from being born. Kali still rides with her servant, Time. Since that first trip, though, Time has carried his own presence. Time gives people the gift of white hairs, and he wraps them carefully in the gold paper of wisdom and acceptance. And so it is. And with that, we will get ready for our next Rio 651. Are you ready? and push 1 on your phone. 651.
Yes, I'm here.
All right.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Just 1 second, please. Are you there, Yusiku? Yusiku, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I was calling the technician to see if he was there. We can hear you loud and clear. Hopefully everyone else can hear you well.
Let me know.
All right, you can go on right now.
Okay, I'm going to be, this is Caledosis in Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes. I'm going to be reading out of the ancient Egyptian wisdom text, compiled with an introduction and commentary by priest professor Muara Ashby. I thought I would go to the one where he's giving instructions to Marikara. I thought this was so important, a commentary, rather than to go into the story, which one can pick the book up and do that. But the commentary is so important to what's going on in the world now. I thought that we ought to go into that.
Yes, please do.
The first teaching, it opens with a declaration to Marikara that a person who is hot-headed incites people. This is easily noted in human nature in people who are constantly argumentative and always seeking to stir up trouble. Why is this? These people have a deep-rooted feeling of discontent, which they constantly strive to feel. Not knowing any better way to stop their feeling of inner sorrow, frustration, and disappointment, they make others miserable and stir up trouble everywhere, thinking that somehow they are attacking the source of their troubles. They feel satisfied when others are agitated, although this is short-lived. This is because the true source of their troubles is their inability to understand and cope with their desires. Ignorant of their divine essence, people seek fulfillment through worldly activities and through worldly means. This inevitably leads to frustration and sorrow. When people act out of sorrow, scorn, and malice, in reality, it is an expression of their pain and ignorance. From a practical perspective, a person who lives by unrighteousness should be denounced to the authorities. Society cannot exist in harmony if unrighteousness is allowed to move freely and unchallenged. Good nature. A virtuous character is a human being. A virtuous character in a human being is what allows a person to experience the divine. How is this possible? Every human being is composed of a body and soul. The soul is pure, immortal, and without malice. However, when the soul associates itself with matter, a human body, in order to acquire human experiences, it forgets its divine origin and falls under the clutches of ignorance and human desires. These desires lead to feelings of frustration, anger, hatred, greed, and so on. These, in turn, agitate the mental nature to such a degree that the divine feeling remains far away. Spiritual practice entails regaining the divine feeling by cultivating good nature in the human heart. This will become clear as we move along. Most people believe that physical might is more important than moral force. When a person uses physical violence, it is an expression of their lack of patience and mental strength. The practice of nonviolence requires great strength and patience. In the end, it overcomes physical might because moral righteousness is based on truth. And truth is an eternal reality and carries a divine sanction. Physical might is a transient phenomena of the material world used by the human ego in order to gain a particular objective in hope of achieving egoistic fulfillment. However, since true abiding fulfillment is not possible in the world of time and space, those who use physical violence will never discover peace. One who studies the teachings, the wisdom of mystical spirituality, develops subtlety of intellect. He or she gains the ability to control the mind and to understand the desires of the heart. They can rise above the pettiness of egoism and thereby control others who are being led by their egoistic desires, since those desires are clouding their intellectual ability. Thus, a learned one is a storehouse of knowledge for all. The teachings are to be studied, copied, and internalized within the heart. Subtlety of intellect allows a sage to cut through the noise of desires in the mind in order to immediately reveal the truth in any situation. There are no illusions in the heart of a sage. Therefore, only truth can exist. In the heart of a passionate person, the truth is seen according to the desires, and that person pursues a course which will fulfill those desires. However, this is a road leading to disappointment and frustration. The masses value fame and fortune, so much so sometimes they do things which are unrighteous in order to receive accolades and praises. They are always concerned about what others think of them, and there is a constant fear of gossip. They maintain a private set of moral standards and a public set. This two-faced way of life is full of tension and stress, and eventually leads to their public ruin. The path of Osiris is the path of righteousness and truth. Those who live according to the precepts of Maat are allowed to move forward on the spiritual journey, while those who lead a life based on vice and untruth, that is, those who indulge themselves in human pleasures and desires and do not restrain themselves, are left behind. This implies a movement towards either enlightenment or a movement towards reincarnation and the cycle of birth and death, wherein the soul experiences being born, growing up, and dying over and over again. The importance of good association is being alluded to here. It is important to have good counsel because life has many possibilities for either situations which lead to happiness or situations which lead to sorrow and frustration. Therefore, true riches should be measured in one's noble, righteous acquaintances rather than material wealth, because those values are perishable and fraught with worldly entanglement, which agitates the mind and draw one into conflict and delusion. There should not be a difference between one's home, private life, and one's public life. There should be truth in all situations of life. One who is truthful engenders respect in all. Unrighteous activity evokes feelings of disrespect and hatred from others. Even though the evil of an evildoer seems to go unpunished, God is the ever-present reality who is aware of every activity and every thought. This is because the human soul is innately related to God. It is the very expression of the divine. Thus, nothing can escape God's awareness. Most human beings believe themselves to be separate and distinct from God. In reality, this feeling of separation is based on ignorance and illusion. The ignorance and illusion is sustained by the mental agitation. However, when peace, harmony, and wisdom are cultivated, spiritual sensitivity is discovered. This is why the wisdom teachings again and again emphasize the need for developing contentment, peace of mind and righteousness. In righteousness, there is no agitation, tension, or stress, because you live for righteousness' sake. You are drawing a divine nectar of divine filling. Truth and God are synonymous. Therefore, living upon truth is, in effect, living on God. It is in this movement which leads to true fulfillment of the needs of the soul, which no worldly activity or object of possession can come close to. This section also implies that there is a big difference between someone who has chanted the writings and who stroll freely in the secret place, as opposed to someone who has not. This is an allusion to the study of the mystical wisdom teachings and the practice of the rituals in the ancient Egyptian temples. One who has begun to study and practice the teachings is special, because spiritual aspiration is a rare occurrence in human life. Once a person truly realizes that there is something other than the phenomenal world of time and space, he or she begins to search for answers to transcendental questions like, who am I? What is my purpose? Is there a God? How am I related to God? This sets them apart from the masses who are only concerned with getting ahead in life from a worldly point of view. They are not interested in the mystical wisdom teachings, but rather with acquiring material wealth and with experiencing the pleasures of the senses. The mass mentality is based on limitation and ignorance, because sense pleasures are fleeting, while spiritual realization is abiding and leads to immortality and supreme bliss. True happiness is when the soul comes to the place it knows. This means that it settles to the place of peace and true happiness. Most people are constantly searching for happiness through worldly means. The soul is never satisfied with these and is constantly agitated, moving, searching. However, when spiritual studies and spiritual practice is engaged in, the soul comes to the place it truly knows. The practice of the teachings, prayer, righteous action, virtuous living, chanting the writings, all constitute the process of giving water to the soul. This passage is of extreme importance to the understanding of mystical philosophy, and it is artistically written so as to convey many powerful teachings in a condensed form. The teacher emphasizes the importance of performing righteous actions in this lifetime, because he will be judged by the assessors of Maat, who exists in a different time reference than the one which is known by ordinary humans. Thus, in the ancient times, we find teachings in reference to the relativity of time and of karma. As a spiritual aspirant, a person is to develop a keen understanding of the relativity of time. In reality, there is no time, only eternity. Out of this eternity, the human mind has recognized elements which it calls events, and has created a concept of time in which those events take place. However, the ancient Egyptians' teachings of creation teach that there are three main realms of existence: physical, astral, and causal. These three realms contain their own apparent realities and their own apparent passage of time, which is relative to the others. Our human being also has three levels of conscious experience. This is why a human being experiences the passage of time differently when in different states of mind. When you are dreaming, you experience a certain passage of time. When you are awake, you experience a certain passage of time. When you are asleep but not dreaming, you experience a certain passage of time. All these experiences are distinct from the others and seem real within their own experience. So which is the real one? Think of eternity as an endless flow of water in a river. Time is like taking a glass and scooping out one drop of that river and living an entire lifetime within that drop. When human life is beset by ignorance, there is only awareness of the drop. However, when spiritual wisdom is experienced through the practice of yoga, it is possible to discover the eternal nature of existence, one's own immortality and divinity. Thus, time is illusory and only has validity in the relative world of human experience. When enlightenment draws on the mind, the absolute, eternal, and transcendental nature of existence becomes revealed in a flash of a moment. Therefore, as a spiritual aspirant, your goal is to develop a keen understanding and discernment between the relative or practical realities to which the mind and body are bound and the transcendental nature of the self within. When living in society and occupying a position of leadership, it is important to raise one's offspring or the youth one is responsible for with the teachings of righteousness and with goodwill. It is important to give abundantly according to one's means and not to hoard one's possessions or wealth. Hoarding promotes jealousy in others, but more importantly, it creates an obstruction to one's ability to care for others. This is because one's primary preoccupation is with acquiring wealth and property and finding ways to protect it from others instead of thinking of ways in which to help people and provide for their welfare. Amassing material wealth and the preoccupation with possessions is the mentality of the masses. Objects do not last even when acquired righteously. Further, they cannot bring happiness or true security. Even the richest person can be swallowed up in an earthquake. And what good would all the riches in the world do for that person? As we will see, true happiness and security comes from relying on the neuter, the God, and not on material wealth. This Hikau contains a profound teaching of mystical spirituality. It teaches the need to maintain equal vision or equanimity of mind, since material wealth is transient and illusory, as we saw in the last passage. A person cannot be judged by his or her material condition. Rather, a person should be judged for their actions and abilities. Since every human being is innately a divine, immortal soul, their potential is limitless. What holds people back is their ignorant understanding of life and egoistic feelings, which lead to sinful behaviors, behaviors based on vices. If you judge others based on their level of material wealth, you are engaging in sin because you are seeing them through your egoistic vision of what is true and real based on ignorance. Virtue is the only true wealth, and it expresses in the form of compassion, nonviolence, truth, universal love, harmony, sharing. Virtue is an expression of one's understanding of the interconnectedness of life and one's own transcendental existence, which is connected to the Supreme Spirit. To the extent that one is aware of one's own divine nature, virtue manifests through the human personality. To the extent that one is in ignorance about one's own divine nature, sinful vice behavior based on greed, jealousy, egoistic desires will manifest. This Hikau refers to material values versus spiritual values of life. Most people are so caught up in the rat race of life and the competition for acquiring success in the world that they neglect spirituality. Spiritual practice or yoga is any activity which serves to bring a person closer to the divine awareness. The goal of yoga and mystical spirituality is to promote integration of the mind-body-spirit complex in order to produce optimum health of the human being. This is accomplished through mental and physical exercises which promote the free flow of spiritual energy by reducing mental complexes caused by ignorance. There are two roads which human beings can follow, one of wisdom and the other of ignorance. The path of the masses is generally the path of ignorance, which leads them into negative situations, thoughts, and deeds. These in turn lead to ill health and sorrow in life. The other road is based on wisdom, and it leads to health, true happiness, and enlightenment. In ancient Egypt, one of the most popular forms of spiritual practice was the ritual worship and identification with the divine. Rituals are a powerful method of engendering a spiritual feeling and for increasing spiritual knowledge. Religion in its complete form has three levels. These are myth, ritual, and the metaphysical or mystical philosophy. If religion is not practiced in its entirety, there will be a misunderstood movement in spirituality. At the level of myth and rituals, all religions of the world appear to be different. However, at the level of mysticism, all religious philosophies are aiming for the same goal, to discover the truth about the universe and of the human heart. Thus, as a person lives in the world of human experience and strives for success, he or she should also engage in daily spiritual practices which will lead to upliftment and which will give direction to life based on sublime goals and aspirations. The ultimate and most sublime goal of life is to discover God and to unite with God. Therefore, all activities in life should be pursued with this goal in mind, making sure that one's actions are not leading one astray through ignorance, overindulgence, and vice. Also, you must realize that life is constantly pressuring you and providing you with messages, advertisement, people, and your own desires are constantly whispering in your mind and urging you to act one way or another, to feel one way or another. Daily spiritual practice allows you to receive an uplifting message which will lead you through the forest of decisions, troubles of life. Those who do not engage in daily spiritual practice are as if alone in the world. They are at the mercy of life situations without a higher vision of life. It must be clearly understood that spiritual practice here implies the process of studying, practicing, and meditating upon the teachings under the guidance of an authentic spiritual preceptor. Many people feel that going to church once a week or reading a spiritual text will lead them to spiritual enlightenment. This idea is limited and will lead to misunderstanding and frustration. This hikau extols the virtue of giving to others and not depriving them. When there is need in a person's heart, it has a way of causing stress and even despair. People can be inspired to greatness with goodness rather than with harshness. When people are inspired by sublime goals and led by those who are righteous, it will engender in them a feeling of righteousness and solidarity. When people work together, there is harmony, and harmony translates into prosperity and more good feeling. Happy is the neuter who represents the now, especially in the flood. The Nile River floods its banks and in so doing bring nutrients and water to the crops which line the banks. Therefore, happy represents prosperity and abundance. Neuters are normally understood as gods and goddesses who emanate from the Supreme Being. However, neuters should be as well understood as cosmic forces which emanate from the Supreme Being and through which the Supreme Being sustains creation. Thus, the neuter permeates creation as well as every human being. In the book, The Egyptian Yoga, The Philosophy of Enlightenment, the teachings of Hikau 24 was introduced. Beware of your environment. Beware of your surroundings. harshness in the surroundings and general environment can cause a negative stress, which could lead to an unsettled mind. An unsettled mind is difficult to control. A mind that is uncontrollable will have difficulty in concentrating. Poor concentration will not allow for reflection. Reflection is necessary to make sense of one's situation and to gain intellectual understanding. A non-reflective, confused, or wrong-thinking mind will have difficulty meditating. A non-meditating mind will have difficulty in transcending the world of apparent dualities. One will be endlessly pulled into the world and the apparent thoughts going on in the mind. As the mind will be caught up in the endless waves of joys and sorrows, it will be unable to find peace. A mind filled with too much joy or too much sorrow due to its experiences in the world will be equally agitated, and one will have difficulty concentrating and calming down. The concept of the miserable Asiatic was also known in Egypt as the concept of the land of Heru and the land of Set. Since Set is the god of the desert, the Asiatics who dwelt in the desert lands became identified with Set, and therefore Setian behavior, impulsive, selfish, brute force. The teachings about the miserable Asiatic is of paramount importance because it provides an understanding of how the human mind becomes degraded and violent. A human being who is not nurtured and who is constantly experiencing stress due to the lack of security, not knowing where the next meal is coming from, how to acquire and secure the needs of life, and then how to hold on to them. All of these worries cause a degradation in the human mind, wherein the concern is not with working with others, but with competing with them for food, material wealth, mates. The purpose of human experience is to provide a means for the soul to experience and grow in awareness of itself as one with creation. This feeling is blissful, supremely satisfying, and universal. When the soul is in a human being, it is not allowed to express itself in this manner. The ego in a human being is in control, and this egoism fosters feelings of personal desire, separation, animosity to anything which prevents the ego from getting what it wants. This is the source of animosity, enmity, anger, hatred and violence in human experience. Spiritual practice leads a human being to discover a deeper essence of life. True spiritual understanding allows a person to understand where true happiness and peace are to be found. It shows a person that security cannot be found in the world, but in that which sustains it. Ancient Egypt suffered many invasions from Asia. Asia includes Greece, Rome, and the land today known as the Middle East. Over a period of thousands of years, the Asiatics tried to conquer Egypt, and through their contact with them, the ancient Egyptians realized the cause of negativity in the heart of the Asiatic people, the disposition towards destruction and causing misery to others. Is a demonic quality which must be confronted by those who are righteous. This is one of the reasons why several ancient Egyptian rulers sought to conquer Asia in order to civilize it and thus secure Egypt from outside attack, as well as to provide the Asiatic people with a higher vision of life. It is written that Osiris and later Ramses II stretched the borders of Egypt to as far as India and southern Europe. This passage also includes another important teaching in reference to the fate of those who engage in sin and negativity, the rebel, the unrighteous person, come by God. At the time of the judgment of a person's actions, a person reaps the reward for his or her deeds. A righteous person should therefore stand up to unrighteousness first by being an example of righteousness and then by pointing out unrighteousness. moral correctness is stronger than physical might. And for this reason, any and all forms of unrighteousness can be overcome by perfection in righteousness. A righteous person should not engage in procrastination, delay, excuses when it comes to asserting the truth, when it means that one's ego will be hurt. One can exercise compassion when telling others of their own mistakes, but one should not allow even a small mistake of one's own to go unnoticed. For example, if an acquaintance is not ready to hear a criticism of their actions, you may withhold the truth until the person is ready to hear it, unless they are in imminent danger. One should not tell the truth indiscriminately if it will only serve to hurt people. This would be an expression of one's own ego. One who has real knowledge, that which comes from spiritual experience, becomes the ruler of the higher self and the lower nature. The way to achieve this is to have proper guidance and good association. This means keeping company with virtuous personalities and those who are wise. Once again, the importance of acting righteous is mentioned. Along with this, it is important to be vigilant not only in one's job or career, but in one's mind. How often does the mind stray into thoughts of negativity, anger, depression, hatred? And how often are these stray thoughts checked before they enter deep into the heart and engender negative activities? A spiritual aspirant must develop vigilance in every aspect of life so as not to allow unrighteousness in their environment, which they have the power to control or prevent. At the end of this hekau, the injunction of karma, which is well known in modern times as what you do comes back to you. Also, this teaching expresses very succinctly a knowledge of the principles which govern creation. These were expressed thousands of years later by Sir Isaac Newton in his Principia, 1687, as three laws of motion. These laws form the basis of the classical study of force and motion. According to the third law, to every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. While Mr. Newton was referring primarily to nature and matter in particular, the ancient Egyptians' reference relates also to human nature and the laws of karmic interrelationship in society as well as in nature. This hekau is very insightful because it shows in a very brief statement that God, who is variously known as the Hidden One, is the knower of the character of human beings. God is the innermost essence of every human being. Therefore, God is the eternal witness to every thought, feeling, or desire which enters the mind. Thus, God knows all characters. God is all-encompassing, and therefore all that can be detected with the human sex senses is endowed with God's presence. Just as the bed or channel of a waterway brings water to one destination, and having reached there, the water takes on a new course in a different channel or waterway. So too, the nature as an expression of the self is ever flowing and relentlessly moving towards the ocean. So too, the soul is relentlessly moving through many incarnations in a search for its true abode. Thus, it is important to worship the self, God, and all forms in creation or expressions as one moves through the path of life. This worship will ultimately lead to self-discovery and spiritual enlightenment. This implies acting in accordance with mayat, truth, righteousness. And also this implies selfless service to humanity and to nature. God and creation are synonymous. Therefore, if you truly propose to work for God, you must understand that God is expressing as the needy, the sick, the homeless, the depressed. Thus, you must render service by doing what you can to alleviate suffering in the world and to promote harmony and goodwill. All creatures on earth and in the universe are your kin, and you should be treating it as sacred beings, no matter how low they have come to be or how high they may appear. This way of life will purify your heart and allow you to see through the pettiness and pathetic aspects of human egoism and ignorance. This final statement of this Hikau emphatically states that living according to this understanding will allow a person to draw divine grace. Divine grace is spiritual wealth in the form of greater inner peace, contentment, wisdom, health, happiness, and the unfoldment of the inner gifts of the soul. This is the basis for the wondrous acts which have been performed by saints and sages throughout the ages. There, what do you think of that?
Thank you very much. Exaltation. That is excellent.
Yes.
I would
there's
like
some
to...
More, we'll, there's yes, some I, more stuff. We'll get into it later.
Yes, I was saying I would like to be able to open the lines later for those who would have any questions or comments, if you'd be able to stay with us. I just have a few more things that I'd like to share with our listening audience tonight, but thank you so much for that exaltation. That is truly ancient wisdom that we all need to recall.
Thank you. I won't be able to stay. I hope we do this again. I want to say also that I appreciate the work that you're doing and the people that come on. I find it very fascinating and very strong. This is what we need.
Yes, yes. I'm so thankful to be able to do it, and I'm thankful to have the associations that I do to help me do what I do, because I am who I am, because you are who you are.
Exactly.
Thank you so much. All right. Peace and blessings. Shalom.
Yes. Shalom. Ciao.
Yeah. All right, audience, I hope that you are still with us. If you need to stretch a little bit, I won't keep you much longer, but we did have 3 hours for this show, but I am going to wrap this up shortly. I just would like to take a few minutes to give homage to some of our ancestors, and I usually just open up a book, and wherever it lands, you know, I know that's what it is that I should do. So I'm going to give honor right now to Robert Marley, born 1945 and transitioned in 1981. Reggae singer, composer, guitarist, born in Nine Miles, Jamaica. Bob Marley grew up in Kingston's tough Trenchtown district. His first group, the Rude Boys, later became known as the Wailers. In 1964, they released their first hit, Simmer Down, which was written in response to gang violence. In 1972, the Wailers were signed by Island Records, and Bob Marley began to gain a worldwide following, especially in Africa. His songs spoke of crime, revolution, Rastafarianism, strength through unity, and human rights. In 1976, 7 men broke into his home in an assassination attempt the night before he was to sing at a concert supporting Jamaican Prime Minister Michael Manley. Wounded in the arm, he nevertheless appeared at the concert. 2 years later, he gave a historic concert emphasizing political conciliation with the song One Love. In 1980, he gave another historic performance celebrating independence in Zimbabwe. Marley died of lung cancer at age 36. One more ancestor that I'd like to recognize, I am a jazz aficionado, is Thelonious Spear Monk, 1917-1982. Jazz pianist, when Monk was 4 years old, his family moved from his native North Carolina to New York, where he began taking piano lessons at age 11. He won several amateur night competitions at the Apollo Theater, but left New York at age 17 to travel across the country with a woman evangelist. Returning to New York a year later, he worked with small groups, becoming closely involved with musicians Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Kenny Clark, and Charlie Christian in the development of bebop. Monk was known for his unusual melodic lines and rhythmic ideas. though he led the first bebop group at the Village Vanguard in 1948, he began drifting away from mainstream bebop and had difficulty finding steady work. His career revived in 1957 when he opened at the Five Spot with John Coltrane. In the early 1970s, he toured with Dizzy Gillespie and a group known as the Giants of Jazz. Monk's unique compositional ability is apparent in such works as Round Midnight, Evidence, Will You Needin', Rudy My Dear, and Blue Monk. So at this time, if there's anyone who would like to make a comment, if you could push number one on your keypad, excuse me, on your telephone. All right. With no further comments from anyone on the line, I would like to do a few more exhortations, and then I'll be wrapping up. These are considered warnings for the times such as now. Support patiently the disagreements inflicted by ignorant men. Fight against fools, and you make matters worse. Keep calm. Don't go anywhere, I beg you. The moon you are looking for is inside you. Realize that everything you need is where you are. Set the lamp, trim its wick, and keep it filled with oil. Don't say you'll act tomorrow. Tomorrow's already gone. Stop delaying. Act now, or your plans will fail. Do not call a cup the sea. Do not call the mad the sage of love. Do not inflate your experience. Honor the true wisdom. If a tree could only walk, he would never have a fear of being chopped down. Keep always changing and growing. Are you dazed from too much meat and wine, or are you a soldier on the field of battle? Look at what you are doing and decide if your motives are selfish or brave. The mirror of the heart must be polished constantly before you can see clearly in it good and evil. Do not rely on your own judgment. Look for guidance. Whoever doesn't show himself humble today will tomorrow be humiliated like Pharaoh. Your pride is putting you in danger. Choose the path of humility. Do not be fooled by appearances. The carnal soul's food is seeds of evil. Sow them, and they grow and grow irresistibly. You are in danger of making very bad choices, which will damage your life. And so it is. And one last exhortation I would like to give. In closing, I'd like to thank you all for joining us here at the Magnolia Tree Institute of Ancient Wisdom in Apiary in Monroe, Louisiana. Again, I'm your hostess, Queen Mother Alahad. I thank our host, UCQL and Ringing Stone Network, for providing this opportunity for us to come to you again. And in closing, I would like to offer a loving treatment. Deep at the center of my being, there's an infinite well of love. I now allow this love to flow to the surface. It fills my heart, my body, my mind, my consciousness, my very being, and radiates out from me in all directions and returns to me multiplied. The more love I use and give, the more I have to give. The supply is endless. The use of love makes me feel good. It is an expression of my inner joy. I love myself, therefore, I take loving care of my body. I lovingly feed it nourishing foods and beverages. I lovingly groom it and dress it, and my body lovingly responds to me with vibrant health and energy. I love myself, therefore, I provide for myself a comfortable home, one that fills all my needs and is a pleasure to be in. I fill the rooms with the vibration of love, so that all who enter, myself included, will feel this love and be nourished by it. I love myself, therefore, I work at a job that I truly enjoy doing, one that uses my creative talents and abilities, working with and for people that I love and that love me, and earning a good income. I love myself, therefore I behave and think in a loving way to all people, for I know that that which I give out returns to me multiplied. I only attract loving people in my world, for they are a mirror of what I am. I love myself, therefore I forgive and totally release the past and all past experiences, and I am free. I love myself, therefore I live totally in the now, experiencing each moment as good and knowing that my future is bright and joyous and secure. For I am a beloved child of the universe, and the universe lovingly takes care of me now and forevermore, and so it is. I love you all. Peace and blessings. Thank you again for allowing me to be with you at this time. One love.